Welcome back to the Rhetoric Warriors podcast, where we are teaching people the power of ethical-only persuasion. We're making a difference in your ability to make a difference, and all sorts of slogans. I like writing slogans. I've got a lot of them.
You're good at it.
I do. I'm Dr. Dan French, American rhetorician, rhetoric PhD, escape professor. That's part of what I do, is this intellectual side of the world. Also stand-up comedian, comedy writer from late night in Hollywood. I like jokes too. I turn everything either into intellectual stuff or jokes. If you want to gather some jokes, find us on social media, especially Twitter. I tweet jokes all day long at Rhetoric War. Here's a few from the week. I went to the Container Store this past weekend and zero coffins. Seems like an oversight. What's that? Maybe Tupperware should make coffins. Pyrex?
Yeah, you just burp it.
Yeah, right. I realized this morning that for most of history, human beings have not had caffeine. Like, how is that even possible? Like 99% of the population gets, you know, into the day with caffeine. That's, I don't want to go back in time. And I'm currently taking bets on where Donald Trump is going to seek asylum. Because I have a feeling the word compound is in his future. Mm-hmm. That and spider hole. So check us out for more jokes. I love the jokes. In this podcast, we talk to comedians about their politics. I find persuasion pros and executives to explore some of the secrets of building good messaging. And I do conversions on people from the right. You can visit us at rhetoricwarriors.com, take a master course in persuasion, and I just launched a new course, Converting Conservatives, how you can change the world by converting one conservative at a time. Go out and get a family member or a friend and bring them back to reality, and that course shows you how. Our guest today, a good friend of mine. We've worked on shows together. He's a longtime comedy writer, stand-up, and executive producer. Has worked on the Chris Rock Show. Everybody Hates Chris. Works a lot with Chris Rock. He created and ran Totally Biased with W. Kamau Bell on FX. Became FXXXXXX. He's written for the Academy Awards, has a few movies under his belt. You name it, he's done it. And he and I share the exact same birthday in the exact same year, May 1st, 1963. Chuck Sklar.
Hey, thanks, Dan. My first question is this podcast visual or merely audio?
It's audio right now. I'm recording them video too. So if I want to, you know, cut into them for YouTube for clips and things like that.
Okay, cool.
You know,
well, then I'm glad I dressed up. So, yeah.
Well, the bar is low for me. I like to set a low bar so my guests don't feel.
I like a Puma sweatshirt. That's cool. Yeah. No, you got my bio right, more or less. And, you know, here I am.
How do you describe yourself these days? I mean, you and I have both been in this industry for a long time and done a lot of things. You've done more than me. You've got some great credits. You get the whole, you moved up to exec producer. I mean, is that how you're selling yourself these days, exec producer?
I've done a lot of, my last 7, 8 years, 10 years maybe, has been head writer, showrunner, which is just a made up word that means executive producer. I'm also a screenwriter. And this past year, I produced a film that my brother wrote and directed.
Yeah, talk about that. That was awesome. That's so cool to see somebody take something all the way full feature length, you know, product.
Yeah. Hats off to my younger brother, Jer Sklar. He's 7 years younger than me. And what's going on behind me? sorry, I'm not in a soundproof booth. Anyway,
but it's probably it's insurgents. They're everywhere, man. They're coming for you.
I'm a little concerned. I saw me and my girlfriend were on a walk just now, and we walked past the guy sitting in a pickup truck on a side street. He had on a tractor hat and a mustache. And I was like, that's a Trump supporter just waiting for orders. He's just sitting there.
God, it's anyway. it's like the day after 9/11, or a couple of days after. I was driving, it was the first time I saw a plane in the air again, and I just freaked out. I'm like, they have completely charged, you know, all that stuff with this new danger energy, and you can't look at it without going, hey, watch out for that guy in that truck.
Yeah, it's weird. And but anyway, the film Time of Your Life, written and directed by my brother Jer, is a great story it's sort of magic realism, in that a baby is born in the middle of the night at a small rural hospital, and it quickly becomes apparent that this infant is aging 4 years every hour on the hour. And 2 hours in, he's an 8-year-old, fully developed.
Yeah, crazy. And a nurse, Benjamin Button's on steroids, right? It's like insane.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's sort of lo-fi. It's not like treated like this crazy dramatic thing. And then, the nurse working in the maternity ward who's got her own set of problems, man problems.
She does have a lot of problems. I noticed that in the movie.
She's a mess. She sees this kid and realizes, like, oh my God, he's going to grow up, live and die all in one day, become an old man and drop dead and never be outside this hospital. So she takes him to Chicago so he can experience life on the one day he has to live it.
Which, if you're going to go and experience life, you can find plenty of that in Chicago, right?
Yeah, it's full of life. And he does, and he has. So it's sort of a road trip odyssey.
Yeah, it's cool. You should check it out. You. I enjoyed that film. There's a lot of fun stuff.
It is presently available on Amazon Prime for Amazon Prime subscribers for free.
For free.
For free now. You used to have to purchase it or rent it, and it is presently free to Prime.
That's what good content, where it ends up, is in the free bag these days.
That's right. They're like, hey, this might draw some eyeballs. And we've got some amazing reviews from like the Chicago Sun-Times and the San Diego Press. We've mostly really good reviews. And we've won a few awards at festivals.
And you're from Chicago, right? I mean, that's your background.
I grew up in suburban Chicago, Highland Park, Illinois, which was a very nice place to grow up, although I hated it. In retrospect, it was like, wow, lakefront trees, just like beautiful old town. But, you know, it seemed like an awful place at the time.
Just wasn't anyway, like enough. It was too not as wild as you are, Chuck. Like,
well, you know, yeah, it's more like I wasn't the kind of I wasn't what they would call a rah-rah in high school. That was a thing. That was a term that was used for people who were like, you know, into school spirit, I guess.
You were more people probably like a na-na.
Like, I was definitely a nana. Yeah. Yeah. I was similar to how I am now. Yep, just less gray hair, thinner. But
same attitude. It has not changed across your lifetime.
You and I were born on the same day in the same year. So we are both 5'7", 57.
Yeah, but you took all the hair. You have kids.
You've had it, you know, you went a different route. I'm actually hoping to be a father still, so we'll see.
Yeah, you and I have had this conversation. I'm like, yeah, it's a beautiful experience 30 years ago, you know? Like, do you know Kostaki Economopoulos? Do you know Kostaki at all?
Yeah, I do know that guy. Like, I think I'm Facebook friends with him.
Yeah, he had a child at 50. He just had a child. So.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, call him and see how it's going. But he had an earlier one, too. He seems to be doing fine. They're super happy with it.
I have a friend or two that had kids in their 50s, and they are buried.
Literally or figuratively?
Figuratively. They are... One in particular is having a hard time, you know, but
if you're still fighting life, if you're still fighting it, you know, if you're sitting on a big pile of money and you don't really need to do that much anymore, then yeah, maybe it could be great. But if you're still fighting life, like all that stress coming at you, and there's nothing compared to like the stress of a human looking at you, like I may die if you don't do things for me.
Right. No, I know. I know. Pretty much all my friends are like, maybe you should.
No, I'm just the opposite. I think you should do it.
Thank you.
Yeah. Go for it. I want to watch it.
It'll be funny, no doubt. Yeah. So anyway, so that the film has been, is done well. We're waiting to hear if we are going to be accepted in, into the Spirit, Independent Spirit Awards.
And talk about that a little bit. Hey, Doug, there's, so this podcast, you know, is ostensibly about persuasion and a mix in comedy and all sorts of different things with it. But so the challenge of getting an original film, you know, up and seen is a persuasion project. It's a marketing project, and it's all these platforms that you've got to learn and all the people that you got to deal with. So when you look at that challenge of taking a message, you know, even a good original message, and showing it to the world, everybody's like, you know, digital platforms, you get all this digital distribution, you get to anybody. Talk about that, because the reality is very different.
Yeah. Well, okay. So we, you know, in a sense, COVID might have been very lucky for us.
Really?
Because we, the film was submitted to several festivals, or was accepted to several festivals. And the first one that we were going to go to, that we went to, was the weekend of March 6th, 2020 in San Jose.
Was that lockdown weekend?
The lockdown weekend was the following weekend. But that weekend, San Jose at that moment was a hotspot of COVID. It was like, I got on a plane and it was weird. And my brother was flying in from Chicago, and my parents were supposed to come in, and my girlfriend was supposed to come up. And after being there 12 hours, I was like, this is crazy. I called my parents. I go, you can't come. They're like, we're coming. Don't worry about it. It's going to be fine. Because who knew? I go, no, you don't understand. It's just not worth the risk. And we had a screening where there was about 19 people tops.
Uh-huh.
And then a couple more. And then they canceled the whole festival, like day two. And we all went home. So then we began trying to find a distributor, a company that is in the business of digital distribution, which is the whole world of independent film and small movies that you've never heard of, like ours, that get out there, and that they have fans, and there's filmmakers that have fans that have, you know, a couple hundred thousand fans or whatever, and they make small films. There's this one company, Gravitas Ventures, and they specialize in low budget. And our film was very low budget, under 200K, in getting it onto platforms. And so we got it to them through my agent, and then we got an offer, and we actually got a couple offers from similar small company, from another small company as well. So we went with Gravitas, and actually my brother had, being very plugged into the world of independent film, and got his master's in film at DePaul a couple of years ago. And in fact, this was his senior thesis, as it turned out.
Is that right?
Or whatever they call it. Yeah, his master's project. And it's very good. And for a first film, it's great.
Yeah. Like, so people don't understand, you know, when you tell people things like, I make this point to people a lot of times who want to get into any kind of entertainment, or, you know, even like this within persuasion about building messages, like, you're only used to seeing super professional media. Nobody is used to seeing even a step down below network and studio and cable. they, you know, you can go to YouTube, but you know that's not professional media.
Right. And you,
so we don't have an aesthetic for anything below super produced high dollar, you know, stuff. So they don't have, they won't forgive you for, you know, the flaws in your product because they just have no, there's no space between absolutely great and, you know, terrible.
Yeah. Both in production value and just like story, just, you know, plot points, whatever. That's one thing to my brother, his goal was, he's like, you don't need $10 million to make a movie that looks good and is a good story. You just have to be, you just have to, and he, you know, he was successful. He wasn't, maybe he wasn't 100% successful, but he was very successful at making a movie that you just get engrossed in. And
but he had some resources. You're a resource. You've worked in the industry for a long time. You could help with the production. You could give advice on the story, you know, professionalizing your messaging. Again, this is, I, you know, how it is. People, especially what I've done going back and forth between LA and Austin, I've gotten approached hundreds of times for people wanting to work on things. And I always, you know, the first thing I assess is how professional they are, like how much professional experience or training do they have? Because I've had things here, like people want me to help with something, produce a movie. And I'm like, well, where's the script? And they're like, well, we're going to let the actors just kind of work their way through it. And I'm like, I'm out. You know, taking the writer out is kind of a bad idea.
Yeah. They saw Curb Your Enthusiasm and they're like, oh, that's not so hard.
Yeah. That's what they all think, that like, we can just improvise our way through. And I'm like, no, that's not a professional idea.
So we had the help of this gravitas to get distribution. And we did on Amazon Prime, on iTunes or Apple, and also video on demand, DVD, etc., Blu-ray, other things that I, you know, but it's available. And then we also hired, you know, they take a percentage.
Right.
And then we hired a promotion, a PR firm for a few weeks surrounding our launch. And, you know, was it money well spent? I'm not sure. I mean,
right. Yeah,
we're going to know at the end of this month how the quarter was, you know.
Is that the way they run that? Like all these different things, they report these on quarters and you don't know what it's doing. You just trust their numbers, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So you really don't hear for like, we're going to hear about the third quarter 2020 shortly. We'll hear about the fourth quarter later in the spring. So we've only had 1 month of sales that we're going to hear about coming up September. And then, we honestly don't know what to expect.
Yeah. But people are looking for content, right? I mean, like you said, the COVID, you're stuck at home and.
Yeah. So we were between people, distributors wanting content and people wanting content, viewers wanting content. It might have been the right time to have a small independent movie.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know if it'll get into the running at the Spirit Awards. It's a long shot. It has no famous people in it, really. So
you're in it? What are you talking about? You're probably the most famous guy in there.
Thank you very much. Mike Nussbaum is a well-known character actor who plays the priest. He's an old man. He was in a lot of films of David Mamet, and he was an actor with Steppenwolf.
Is that right? So he does have some kind of, you know, residual, like,
he's legit. He was in Things Change. He was in House of Games.
So there's all these, again, people don't realize all they do is they get the end product, the end experience of viewing something. They don't see all that architecture underneath it, you know, about what it takes to get, like you said, a distributor and they take a cut, and you need PR because the distributor or the platform isn't going to advertise you. They're going to put a, you know,
they don't do shit.
A thumbnail up there that maybe somebody can see as they scroll around, right? But even the decisions on who's going to be at the top of the
scroll.
There's
also like the artist, the design of the poster, which were, I'm very happy how it came out, but that was laborious and had, you know, a lot of opinions, and we got a good one though.
Yeah, and you guys have a good title. I think the Tom of Your Life hooks people, right? You know, it's got a nice pun in there, and I think
cool.
I think to me, like, that's a super value when you title something really well, especially in this environment where if the people breezing past it, you know, if there's not a if the title doesn't grab you, that's your first big loss persuasively, because you get one half a second of awareness of what you've got, and if you don't start putting hooks right into it, you don't have a chance.
Yeah.
Who came up with the title?
As far as I know, Jeremy did. He had somebody who, the concept was all his, but he developed the story with James Sharp, who is one of the actors in it as well, and was the hands-on nuts and bolts producer. And he's a great guy and really good actor in the movie, actually. And might be the best, most believable performance in the movie.
Which one is he?
He's the private detective chasing after them.
Yeah.
Huh. He's very grounded. Well, you know what it is? It's not like, oh, he's the best. He's a very grounded, solid character. And then the other two main characters are all nuts or have wild shit going on, like aging 4 years an hour. So yeah, it's really, it's cool that he has this gravitas, so to speak. Anyway, but he and my brother developed the story, and then Jeremy banged the script out, and I read in about a month, and I read it, and I was like, I think this is really, really good. This is like 4 years ago, three and a half years ago. I think you're, because, and he had raised money to make a project, and he had another script that was more expensive. He needed like another $400,000 for it. He's like, I can't make this movie for $120,000, which is all he had. So, I'm gonna develop this other thing, Tom of Your Life. I'm like, okay, good luck. But then I read the script, then he banged the script out, and I was like, this is actually better than the other script. So things have a way of, but he's very, he is hung with it, as you say. He has followed through to the max.
Yeah.
And now it's out there in the world, and that's got its own kind of stress.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, again, like all this stuff, I had somebody contact me recently, a comic that I really like, and I've always liked her, and she has never had any kind of team around her to put anything really together. So she could, you know, stitch together enough stand-up to get a good stand-up kind of hour. And now she wants, you know, an online presence. And I'm like, great. And she's like, I want you to produce it. And I'm like, great. I said, so what's your budget? And she's like, I don't know. And I'm like, well, I said, just give me a payment to get started. Like, it was like a grand. I'm like, just something. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, like a month and a half later, I'd done some stuff for her. And I'm like, okay, so we need to put a budget together. What are you going to pay every month? And she's like, I don't have any money. I'm like, well, then you don't have any help. You know, how are you going to get people to help you? You know, especially, you know, with all the effort and work, like you're talking about, something like that takes. You can't do it on, you know, volunteerism and this idea that people have of just amateur, everybody pile in.
Yeah. You want to be like, either you're paying me cash now, or I'm taking a cut of your, I mean, like your manager, I'll take 15%.
Yeah. And you can only do those. Like, I've done those, and you know what happens with that stuff.
I've never really done that, to be honest. I've mainly... No, I guess that's not true. I have literally, and in fact, presently, I'm helping a guy, an actor who is a would-be writer, and he has a really good idea for a script, and he's written the pilot, and I've helped him. I've just read the drafts and told him what I thought. And then he wants me to take out the show with him and be attached to the showrunner, and which is nice, of course. But the question is it good? Is right. it good enough? Is it marketable? And I'm kind of happy to help people. Either I want to get paid or it's for free, you know. But I haven't become a manager.
Yeah, it's an odd position anyway. To be. I've helped tons of stand-ups with that stuff because I enjoy it. You know, I really like working on stand-up, and there are people out there that I think are really funny, but they just don't have, you know, the dimensionality of skills that it takes to put something fully together. So you look like you've got 40% of a great fuel reactor here, but you'll never do the other 60%. And so I'll try to help, but ultimately it's too much work, you know, and I can't do all the other 60% either. I can do whatever I do. And then you need a guy like you.
And the other thing is a lot of times you might know better, but it doesn't matter because they know what they want. They know what they like and what they want to do. And then you kind of have a like, hey, if you don't want to take my advice, then fuck off.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like the one guy I worked with really well, I told him right up front, I said, hey, I'll help you do all this stuff, but I'm the head writer, script writer. I don't want to hear any reaction to anything from you. Just do the script like an actor. And he's like, great. And he did it. And everything worked just fine. But, you know,
that's amazing. Rare.
So you produced, you know, like a political show, like Kamau Bell, totally biased. And Rock always does politics too. Talk about some of that a little bit. Like, what was that like, especially with Kamau Bell? Like, I assume your politics were fairly close to each other. He's a lefty. I assume you're a mostly lefty.
Well, he's very progressive.
But his is probably farther beyond yours, I would think.
Yeah, he's beyond me. Actually, we're not that far apart. I think he might think we are.
Yeah.
Because I'm not, I mean, to his credit, he was sort of like, and this is like 8 years ago now, like ahead of the curve on things like transgender rights and just the, not the Me Too movement because it didn't exist, but just the feminism, I guess, really, for want of a better word. Not that I was opposed to those things, but he was, you know, an actual proponent of them.
Yeah, he's a super progressive. Like his show now, what's his show now on CNN?
I don't know.
United Shades of America. You know.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And it's an extension of a totally biased, it seems like to me in some ways. But I mean, talk about that. What was that development process like? You came through, you know, you've been Chris Rock's favorite, one of his favorite writers for a long time. And you guys developed that. So talk about that a little bit. Cause he was, I think they picked him cause he was supercharged politically and they want to try to do stuff like that, you know, like better than Marr. Like Marr is the guy on the left who's made a, you know, living about being able to do that. But they keep trying to get a person who actually is representative of the left.
Yeah. You know? Well, what happened with that show was I saw Kamau do his one man show in like 2009. And I had been invited to look at it by Comedy Central. And because they were thinking of developing something with it. And I called them up the next day and I met Kamau there. I go, great, that was great. You're gonna have a show. I don't know if I'm gonna be involved in it, but and then I called Comedy Central and said, hey, I thought he was great. Let's do something. And they said, well, yeah, but nobody's ever heard of him. And I go, right. You called me. What are you talking about?
Now pitch him to us.
I go, okay. I forget if it was on the phone or even in a meeting because it was quite a while ago, but I was just like, well, that's weird. So I just called up some people that I knew at HBO and talked up Kamau to them and sent them tape of his show and his stand-up. And there was some interest, but it ultimately crashed on the rocks of, who is this guy? Mm-hmm. You know, because HBO is sort of a, especially at the time, was very much about star fucking.
Yeah,
for giving third chances to the Dennis Millers and Bill Maher's of the world.
Yeah,
you know, great comedians who have washed up on their shore after washing out elsewhere.
Right.
So, but you know. So that it was Kamau, and I said to Kamau, we need in some name power. So I sent his tape to Chris Rock. Chris watched it and went, wow, this guy is really good. But you know, I don't know, something like that. So I go, well, think
so
about
a
it.
Ringing maybe endorsement.
Yeah. He was like, he liked it, but he wasn't sure what to make of it. So then a year goes by, literally a full year. I was, believe it or not, in Austin, Texas. I'll never forget this because I was at the Austin Film Festival in 2010, and where you and I reprised our starring role of talking about late night writing on a panel.
Those were fun, man. Cool. I missed those panels.
That was fun. Yeah. So Chris calls me. He goes, well, I just came from the Fringe Festival in New York. I saw Kamau Bell's one-man show. And wow, you were right. He's something else. That's he's got a voice. There's a show there. Let's do it. So long story short, another year went by. We had a couple of fits and starts because we all had projects going on. Life, Kamau had a baby. I was working. And then we made a little pilot and we sold it to FX with Chris attached as the big name producer, me as a showrunner, and Kamau as a talent. And we shot a little demo thing in Santa Monica at the Third Street Promenade Comedy Theater. And it was pretty good. I mean, it was a good showcase for Kamau. And that was in the fall of 2011, and in the summer of 2012, we were on the air and we had an order for six episodes.
That's it? Episodes. For a talk show?
Yeah. Six weekly episodes. And we ended up doing 26 straight weeks. Cause it was working right out of the gate.
Yeah. You guys, it was great. I thought, like, I remember watching the pilot episode and going just that. I'm like, oh yeah, this guy can power this format. There's nobody else that's really, you know, come out of the left, out of the progressive millennial kind of, you know, politics comedy who can do that. Mm-hmm. And he could handle it.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was good. And we, you know, we were largely the victim of our own success because it was well received critically, very well received by the New York Times and the New Yorker and everybody and Variety, whatever. And we got some good numbers. We also got some good numbers amongst the interesting demos. Like we had a great numbers with women. Women aren't usually watching late night,
right?
But women really like Kamau. And we also had, it was like, woke before woke. That's really
right.
What it was.
Yeah, that's what I said. You guys were right there before that wave of all that energy came, and he had captured a lot of it already, you know?
Yeah, I don't remember when the word woke happened. Was it 2016 or 2015? But we were
woke.
We were awakened early. And it was fun. It was a fun show. And unfortunately, they decided this show is so great, it's going to anchor our new network, FXX.
Yeah.
Season two of this show was going to be, instead of once a week, five times a week, five half hours. 2.5 hours of content a week about these very, from this very progressive viewpoint. I'm like, you know, Rachel Maddow does that every night, but she isn't a comedian. She's just trying to have opinions, and she is trying to be funny, actually.
Yeah.
But and she's okay. But, you know, she's not, if she doesn't, if jokes die on her show, nobody's upset.
Yeah, that's right.
So,
yeah.
Okay. So we, that was just the killer that, and it couldn't sustain. We were on the air for 10 weeks, I think, total. And we were also moved to FXX, which was a new channel that nobody knew where it was.
That nobody knew about. Yeah. You guys, yeah. They totally, you know.
They fucked us really hard. And they know it. The network owned their their error. But nevertheless, Kamau didn't respond well to it. It was, the show did not survive that.
Well, and talk about this for me, because I'm always curious about this. You and I, again, are exactly the same age. We're both, you know, middle to getting to later age white guys in, you know, the wokest of the woke kind of industries of entertainment and things like that. And when you see, you know, people a lot of times, I think, pigeonhole creatives as, well, you're creative within your, you know, your genre, within your demographic. And good creatives can move around, and you've clearly done that, right? Moving around to help other cultures. Comedy is comedy. You know, it has cultural differences, but the mechanisms are all the same, right? Mm-hmm. So you're not, you know, you're in there, and like, I've seen people be like, well, you know, if it's a Black-oriented progressive show, then like the EP and the writers and everything else should be Black-oriented or Black progressives. You know, or if it's a mm-hmm. female show, it should be all female writers. And I find that to be just a basic misunderstanding of what creativity is.
It's really reductive. I mean, the great thing about Totally Biased was we had a totally diverse staff. There was 3 or 4 Black writers and 3 or 4 women, 2 South Asian Americans, Hari Kondabolu and Aparna Nancherla. 2 really funny people, comics, and Kevin Kataoka, and plus a couple of old white guys, me, Danny Vermont, Ned Goldreyer, Brian McCann, great comedy writer. Anyway, and I'm forgetting some people, and also, but then there was Dwayne Kennedy, one of the all-time most funny people out there.
Great stand-up.
Great stand-up. Kind of a mentor of Kamau's. That's his, it was his, how he kind of came to it. And it was great. And he was also, and all these, most of those people that I just mentioned were also on camera a lot. Mm-hmm. And there was a girl named Janine Brito. And a lot of these guys were new. Because they were Kamau's crew.
Right.
Out of the Bay Area. But they popped, most of them, and it was really it was a really rewarding experience that was diverse without anybody having to say anything, because we just, that's who Kamau wanted, and he wasn't like, I don't want any white people. He was like, I want, you know, he wanted people that would help him with his voice.
Sure.
And that was a diverse group.
Well, and I've always, you know, part of my degree is in cultural studies. Like a third of my classes in graduate school were cultural studies. Cause I always draw a lot from other cultures. You know, I like those environments, and I don't know, I don't really consider myself to be representative of my demographic anyway. I'm not particularly, I look like, you know, a bouncer, but I'm not, that's not my, my personality, you know, right. That kind of stuff. So, you know, I think some people do, they do the reductionist thing. And a lot of the stuff I do in Rhetoric Warriors is about right now, it's about bringing the right back to sanity, you know, because the right is causing so many problems politically. But there's a lot of overreactive people and hyper emotionalized people on the left too. And they need some help.
Yeah. And in our business, it's just like I mean, in this script that I've recently written about an older white writer who can't get arrested in his own industry because of the diversity push. And it's like, hey, diversity is great, but isn't white also one of the, and it's like, isn't it discrimination to be discriminatory and say, we're looking for non-white writers. So you need not apply. Or, you know what, apply, but it's going to be a tough row because we're really looking for BIPOC, Black or Indigenous People of Color. And
that's, I've had, I mean, it's a reality, you know, this reaction, and I understand it theoretically. I had this when I was in academics. So academics is the same thing. It's a hyper-political environment. And then I go over to entertainment. It's a hyper-political environment. And my first job at Best and Sports Show, they were doing two-day test trials for writers, which are illegal with the guild. But they brought me in, a guy, you know, recommended me and brought me in. And the head writer told me, he goes, well, you know, they've slotted this as a diversity hire, so we can't hire you, but come on in and, you know, let's see what you can do. And I'm like, okay. And I ended up staying there, you know, almost 2 years, and they never hired me because they didn't want to put me on the, you know, another white guy on the roster.
I understand.
You know,
it's and so I get ridiculous.
I totally get it. I understand politically why that is. And I agree even with it, you know, philosophically, that you're making up for a lot of, you know, oppression for groups and sort of advantages for white males. But I'm a human, I'm an individual. I can't be brought into the making up for things, you know, and they do. Yeah. It's like, I'm not responsible for those forces being in the world.
I've had more than one agent say to me, there's a job opening at such and such, say Jimmy Kimmel, they're looking for a head writer. I go, okay, great. Get me in a meeting. And they go, well, they want it to be diverse. Do you know any diverse writers who, if we got them a job, would hire you? And I'm like, yeah, I do. But they fucking have agents.
Right.
And they don't, you know what I mean? Because they're great, famous writers.
Yeah.
That's our strategy. And they're like, we're just trying to be creative, Chuck. And I'm like, yeah, I see. You're trying to do something, I guess. Whatever.
It is hard. I mean, you're working against, like I said, political forces, and I totally get that. But again, historical forces. But when it comes to it, you're an individual trying to make a living, and economic forces, and you've worked hard to become good at something. And for that not to be the determining factor, that's difficult to take.
It really is. And one could say, yeah, just like it was difficult for women and people of color who were discriminated against and not allowed in because they weren't white men. Okay, I get it. So it's payback time. Is that going to make the world a better place? Payback time. I see that what the aggrieved white man is not a posture anybody wants to promote. Okay, I'm all for diversity, but I'm like, the word overcorrection comes to mind.
Yeah. And I think that's fair, right? I think if people look at it intellectually, that's why I said, I understand it intellectually and I even agree with it politically. I think long-term disadvantaged groups need advantages in order to catch up. But the reality of that, you know, especially in industries like ours, you end up just, you know, cutting all these individuals out who have no culpability in any of those issues. The only culpability is the color of our skin or our gender, you know, our age. You see, you know, Bill Burr, like we talked a little bit about Burr, like some of the comics that try to come back against this, they have to have such a strong intellectualism to give themselves a legitimate foundation to talk about it, because you can there's so many word landmines and there's so many idea landmines, you know, that if you get outside just a little bit, you get crushed. And so you have to be very careful working your way through there. So like your script, I'm sure, like, you know, that's the kind of stuff that you're dealing with.
Yeah, you do have to really walk this line because you don't want to be like, hey, fuck all these minorities. I want what's mine, you know. At the same time, you don't want to just have no teeth. You want to be like, yeah, there's anger. Like, it's like, but you don't want to seem like some, like, it's like a Trump thing. Like,
yeah,
the Trump supporter, not the person who's beating somebody with a flagpole, but just a normal person who might have feel aggrieved and be like, where's my, the world's changed. Where's my place in it? Okay. That's a commonality that I can feel with somebody that I would otherwise consider to be a complete idiot. Because I'm sometimes like, okay, what is my place? There's this new environment of, you know, it's not like I haven't worked. I've worked, you know, a little bit last year, but mostly not. And the year before that, I was working full time. So, but mind you, I've been working for Chris Rock mostly. Mm-hmm. He's the one person left who hires white guys.
That's funny.
Anyway.
Well, it's, and like I said, it's this difference in experiential, like trying to make your way in the world, working hard, getting good at a job and wanting to be allowed to do that job because you deserve to do that job and you work it hard and do it well. And that's all the things that are supposed to qualify you for a job in this world, in a meritocracy, right? Worked hard for it, have skills, ready to work, bring me in. And then on the other side, the political politics of it, and you touched on exactly right. This is a lot of the energy in the Trump movement. The people that, hey, the world has shifted under me. You told me all these things to do all these things. And I feel like I've done them. And now I'm being cut out of the rewards of them. And they get this big sense of being cheated and being lied to and all that energy.
You know? And it's easier to hate a foreigner or a person of another religion or another skin tone than it is to go, how am I going to reinvent myself? Because when you're over 45, really, and you're like, what do I, like, you're, you know, what's, and I'm ignorant about this. Like, I don't really know who's this archetype person. Are we talking about like a person who worked in manufacturing and had a good job that he could send his kids to college on 25 years ago, and now he doesn't? Or what? Like, or, and now this guy has to work driving Uber. Like, I don't know.
I think all those things are fair, right? Like the underpayment of almost everybody in every sort of normal job. Like my dad was a home remodeler and his dad was a home remodeler, and they, you know, had, my grandfather took 4 to 6 weeks of vacation to go down to Florida when it was cold, had two cars, had a boat, you know, and didn't work that hard. And then I watched my old man work really hard and never really make money. And so I think a lot of people that economic, you know, under deliver on the promise of, you know, American, I work hard and therefore I can have a decent life. Everybody's feeling that, you know?
Yeah. Everybody is feeling that. It's true. Yeah, it's a tough one. Like the world is really in a fragile place right now, or at least maybe not the world, but people. people in free countries, there's a lot of fragility.
Yeah, I think that's true. It's a lot of things feel like they could tumble one way or the other really badly and really quickly.
And they have. This year, between the pandemic and the almost toppling of our own government.
Right.
Maybe that's, I mean, you know, what the hell?
Aren't those apocalypses? I mean, those are apocalypses. That's traditionally, like, literally, a plague that's wanting to take out, you know, the population. That's the Black Death from Europe. We keep running ahead of it a little bit, not letting it catch us. And the same thing with the insurrection of overthrowing a government. We just running over, you know, just staying ahead of it. It's like nipping right at the, you know, back of our necks. You're like, man, is this thing going to catch us for real?
Yeah, there's like two movies that spring to mind that would encapsulate the last year: Contagion and Red Dawn.
That's funny. And well, I mean, the idea of the communists coming from outside, like we've seen, you know, the threats, but very little do you ever see internal threat movies like that, like where it's just being taken down from the inside.
Yeah.
America wasn't ready for that stuff.
I guess there's a novel that's famous, an underground novel written in the 70s, that's basically about this, and it's like a Bible to these kooks. I was just saw an article about it. And it just sounded, you know, it was all about, it was basically like a primer on how to do it. How to, what do you do? How do you destabilize? And it was written, you know, before the age of social media, internet, or anything like that. But it was, I guess, all these nut job gun toting. You know, the funny thing is, like, they're all worried, like, the government's going to come for our, take our guns. Yeah, now they are.
Yeah, you've given them reason.
You fucking idiot. You brought it to Washington and publicly said you wanted to shoot Mike Pence.
Yeah, I was talking to my son about it today. He's 18 and, you know, he's looking at all this stuff with no historical background. He has no experience with politics or, you know, any of this stuff. And he's like, yeah, because he's living down near the Capitol in Austin. And he's like, should I be worried about, you know, being too close to the Capitol on Inauguration Day? And I'm like, well, I think, you know, the world has shifted on those guys who show up in cosplay, you know, military garb like G.I. Joe. Like, there's going to be 20,000, you know,
yeah,
National Guard at D.C. this time. I want to see them storm the Capitol now.
Yeah, by the way, I've been at two inaugurations for Obama, and the place is on lockdown. Like, they're saying, like, right now it feels like the partitioned part of Baghdad,
right?
You know, whatever that was called. And that's what it's like. It's like you can't cross roads. There's huge barricades up. The only cars on the road are armored cars and tanks.
That's crazy. It's like, it wasn't like intense. That for Obama, right? I imagine that was a big party.
Well, no, it was. I'm telling you, Obama, especially the first one, was an amazing event. It was brutally cold, but the presence of security was so high and so over the top.
Hmm.
It was armed. It was an encampment.
Well, I guess the black president thing is always, you know, it's like the Richard Pryor bit about the first black president, you know, just ducking
on
while he's giving his speech. You know, so that's inciting clearly to a certain segment of the population. So,
yeah. Anyway, what a world.
What a world. And we're still in it, chugging away, writing scripts, trying to get a movie out there about it. Do you have a political agenda with that? Or are you just trying to, you know, do some entertainment and make some money?
Which?
On your current film script, like, it has a strong perspective in it. Like, you could argue that you're trying to fight back against some of the forces that have come at you. Do you feel politically motivated in comedy, or are you just, I like to do entertainment and I like to make money?
I like to tell a true story. I don't feel like, I don't want my message of that story of a writer who's can't get work to be I'm using the drama of our time. I would be doing something else if this wasn't happening.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a message, I guess, but I think it's a good area for comedy.
Yeah, so you're mostly motivated by just the fun of it, the comedy in it.
Honestly, yeah. Like, I mean, really, my dream project is a feature script about, set in Detroit in 1968, about a guy that sells burglar alarms door to door. But first he steals your television. And then he shows up the next day selling burglar alarms.
Yeah, it's funny. I've read that script.
Right. Yeah, it's evolved. That script's evolved.
But it's comedy. You know, it's like, it's a cultural snippet from the 70s, and it's, you know, it's fun. It's you're not trying to make a big point there.
Yeah. No, I'm not. It is a slice of life in a, you know, volatile year, 1968, post-riot Detroit. So it has a political element. And in fact, the latest draft that I've did this year, I utilized a lot more of the politics of the era or the tensions, which were in it, but I was, you know, I wasn't as good as a writer 10 years ago when I originally wrote it as I am now. So right. I've improved it.
Well, and I think you're right. You know, the one thing is Trump has done is he's broken open the political pinata. So it's everywhere. It is the zeitgeist of the times right now. You can't get away from it. So it's going to filter into everything. It's filtering into commercials. You know, it's filtering into all the, you know, film scripts and everything else. You're just going to see this huge welling up of that, you know, within the creative communities, because it's just in everybody's face all the time.
Yeah. Well, how is it in commercials? I'm curious.
Like even the way people in commercials now are wearing face masks, you know, and like Ford has come out like, you know, during these, you know, tough times, we get tougher and, you know, stuff like that. So they're responding to the zeitgeist that's going around.
Yeah.
It's crazy. So, well, it's been fun, man. It's always fun to talk.
Great. Great to see you. We haven't Zoomed in this new era. So
that's true. I think, you know, soon the Zoom will have to be on 24 hours legally. You can't ever turn off your Zoom.
Oh my God. Is there going to be an Austin Film Festival this year?
Well, it usually rolls out in October. I can't see it. I can't see there being a vaccination by that time for them to make it viable. I mean, it wasn't a particularly super, it was a very viable festival, but it wasn't, you know, super profitable. So I can't imagine them being able to do it if it's going to be 60% less or whatever.
Oh yeah.
But I don't know, like the comedy club here died. They closed that, Cap City closed.
I heard that. It's a shame.
Yeah, it was a great club. It was there for, you know, 30 years. So all these things that, hopefully they'll reemerge as different things, you know, but we'll see.
All right, man. Well, one of these days you're going to be back out here in LA, and I'm definitely going to visit Austin again. So we'll hang out, get some barbecue.
We will do it. Well, thanks again, Chuck. This has been Rhetoric Warriors. We will see you again next week, where you continue to learn everything that you ever wanted to know about persuasion.